No one in Haiti wants to think about the next big one. But scientists now studying last month's quake say it could have been worse, and a more damaging quake is likely sooner or later. NPR's Richard Harris reports from Haiti's capital.
The quake struck southwest of Port-au-Prince, but in order to understand what could happen next in Haiti, earthquake scientist Eric Calais has headed 30 miles north to the town of Saint-Marc. We pull up at a blue and white cinder block building, the local police station. After a brief conversation with the officer at the counter, the scientific team pulls an extension ladder off the top of its vehicle and leans it up against the station.
Okay, up on the roof.
Yeah, up on the roof. Now we need to find the benchmark.
Calais is looking for a metal disc the size of a dime, which his Haitian colleagues installed here some years ago. After a few minutes of poking around, we find it. Calais then assembles something that looks like a cross between a radar dish and a frisbee, and they carefully install it right over the benchmark. This is a GPS receiver, but far more accurate than your handheld model. With 3 days of measurements, Calais, from Purdue University, will know the precise location of this spot to within a millimeter, the thickness of a fingernail. And that's important because he needs to measure how parts of Haiti are moving relative to one another. That's why earthquakes happen here.
Well, these measurements here right after the earthquake are important to make because we still don't understand exactly what happened during the earthquake. We need to know what the rupture was during the earthquake, how much slip there was at depth.
That is critical in figuring out the risk of future quakes. Rough estimates now are that 6 miles underground where the quake started, the fault slipped 15 feet. At the surface, the north of Haiti moved about 3 feet relative to the south. Calais will nail down those numbers once he measures the exact positions of more than 30 of these benchmarks around Haiti. One thing earthquake scientists have already learned is that during the January 12th quake, Port-au-Prince caught a break. Most of the energy from the earthquake actually focused to the west, away from the densely populated capital.
Of course, Port-au-Prince was still hit because seismic waves propagate anyways in all directions, but much less so than if the opposite had happened, a rupture going from west to east.
So if the direction of the energy from this quake had pointed in the other direction, how much worse would it have been for Port-au-Prince?
Well, it's hard to quantify this, but it could have been, twice worse.
Another break for Port-au-Prince is that all the measurable aftershocks, at least so far, have been centered farther away from town than the original quake. There have been more than 70 so far, and they will continue for months. Just where, nobody can say. But Port-au-Prince's relative luck won't last forever. The quake apparently shifted more strain onto the eastern segment of the fault, and that runs right through densely populated parts of Port-au-Prince. Seismologists at the U.S. Geological Survey have calculated there's a 2% chance of a magnitude 7 quake on this length of the fault between late January and February 22nd. Calais doesn't get too excited about that short-term assessment, though the story of two massive quakes here in 1751 isn't exactly comforting.
There is a history of two earthquakes within essentially a month on this fault, and it could happen again, and it could not happen. This is something we just don't know.
One thing he can say is that the risk to Port-au-Prince is high in the medium term, and that message is now starting to spread throughout Haiti, thanks to the efforts of the country's only earthquake scientist. Back in Port-au-Prince, we asked Claude Prepetit whether he was more concerned about the aftershocks right now or the possibility of another major quake right on the fault that runs through heavily populated areas of Port-au-Prince.
I'm concerned about both. A lot of people are sleeping outside and they want to get back into their house. So we must manage the situation. But also for the future, we must be concerned about it. Because at any time, the rest of the fault line could move. So we must consider all those criteria when we are rebuilding.
The overwhelming challenge is to figure out how to turn that concern into actions that will eventually make this population safer. Richard Harris, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
With snow blanketing much of the country, the topic of global warming has become the butt of jokes. Climate skeptics built an igloo in Washington, D.C. during last week's storm and dedicated it to former Vice President Al Gore, who's become the public face of climate change. There was also a YouTube video called 12 Inches of Global Warming that showed snowplows driving through a blizzard. For scientists who study the climate, it's all a bit much. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, they're trying to dig out.
Snowed in Washington is where much of the political debate over climate change happens, so it did not go unnoticed when a Washington think tank that advocates climate action had to postpone a climate meeting last week because of inclement weather. That kind of irony isn't lost on climate scientists. Most don't see a contradiction between a warming world and lots of snow. Here's Kevin Trenberth, a prominent climate scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado.
The fact that the oceans are warmer now than they were, say, 30 years ago, means there's about, on average, 4% more water vapor lurking around over the oceans than there was, say, in the 1970s.
Warmer water means more water vapor rises up into the air, and what goes up must come down.
So one of the consequences of a warming ocean near a coastline like the East Coast and Washington, D.C., for instance, is that you can get dumped on with more snow, partly as a consequence of global warming.
And Trenberth notes that you don't need very cold temperatures to get big snow. In fact, when the mercury drops too low, it may be too cold to snow. There is something else fiddling with the weather this year, a strong El Niño. That's the weather pattern that every few years raises itself up out of the western Pacific Ocean and blows east to the Americas. It brings heavy rains and storms to California and the south and southeast. It also pushes high-altitude jet streams farther south, which brings colder air with them. Trenberth also says El Niño can lock in weather patterns like a meteorological highway so that storms keep coming down the same track. True, those storms have been big ones, record breakers. But meteorologist Jeff Masters with the website Weather Underground says it's average temperatures, not snowfall, that really measure climate change.
Because if it's cold enough to snow, you will get snow. We still have winter, even though the temperatures have warmed on average, about 1 degree Fahrenheit over the past 100 years.
Masters says that 1 degree average warming is not enough to eliminate winter or storms. A storm is part of what scientists classify as weather. Weather is largely influenced by local conditions and changes week to week. It's fickle, fraught with wild ups and downs. Climate is the long-term trend of atmospheric conditions across large regions, even the whole planet. Changes in climate are slow and measured in decades, not weeks. Masters and most climate scientists say a warming climate would be expected to affect the weather, sometimes drastically, but exactly where and when is hard to predict.
In that kind of a climate, you'll have more frequent extreme events, heat waves and so on. But again, none of those individual events is proof in itself that the climate is changing.
Climate scientists say they can't prove any single weather event is due to climate change. Thus, they say Katrina or the heat wave in Vancouver that's dogging the Olympics isn't proof that climate change is happening, nor can eastern and southern snowstorms prove that it's not. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
NPR's Philip Reeves visits an island on the edge of the Bay of Bengal, and it's not just any island. They are directly threatened by the changes in the world around them. Their land is being swallowed up by a rising sea.
The mid-morning ferry from the mainland has just pulled in. Hundreds of passengers jostle with each other as they stream down the jetty. They're arriving from India's east coast after a short journey across the soupy, flat waters of a giant estuary. The island's quayside stallholders are waiting eagerly. They're cranking on hand presses, turning sugarcane into juice. A man sits on a mat surrounded by exotic shells, advertising his wares by blowing on a conch. This is a good place to do business. Thousands come here to Sagar Island every day. Sagar is part of the Sundarbans, a low-lying archipelago that straddles India and Bangladesh. It's wrapped in the world's largest block of mangrove forest and fans out into the Bay of Bengal. Amid this spray of islands, mudflats and swampy jungle lives the endangered Royal Bengal tiger, an amazing animal that drinks salt water, swims for miles and occasionally kills an inhabitant. The delta is home, too, to man-eating crocodiles. It's also home to a lot of people, more than 4 million just on the Indian side. They include Varun Pike. Pike is a tough, wiry-looking farmer in his 50s. He's spent his life on Sagar Island. Today, he's standing on a long, wide beach, pointing a finger out to sea.
2 kilometers.
A mile or two out, beneath the grey waves, lies most of his land, he says. Pike's surrounded by the rubble of a giant brick wall. Large, broken lumps of brickwork are scattered along the beach in a straight line, as far as the eye can see. This is the remains of a barrier built by the authorities. A cyclone ripped down the wall a few years back. Pike now only has 2 acres close by the beach. His land's recently been flooded several times. He thinks it's only a matter of time before it's completely swallowed up.
This year all my land will be gone because the barrier is gone.
Durga Pal lives here too. She's small and middle-aged and weathered by nearly half a century of island life. She says her family's also lost most of its land.
Our grandparents and our parents, they all used to stay here. And we had a lot of wealth and a lot of land before this. But now we are left with very little land and very little money to survive on.
Pal says many people in her village have left.
Happy.
50. Half the community's left because of the sea coming in. What will you do if the sea does come onto your last remaining piece of land? What will you do, sir?
She's not sure, but she and her neighbours are sure about why the waters are devouring their land.
The god is responsible for it.
Gods and gurus play a big part in the life of this island. Saga Island stands at the point where the Ganges, Hinduism's holiest river, flows into the sea. Once a year, hundreds of thousands of pilgrims gather here for one of Hinduism's largest religious festivals. Most of the island's small thatched mud homes have their own shrine. There are hundreds of temples. At the best known of these temples, a group of women is worshipping. Baba Jitendra Das is one of its priests. He says Hindus come here from all over the world. The temple is about 300 yards from the beach. Das says when it was first built, it was situated a couple of miles away, on land now underwater.
Before this, there were 3 temples which were destroyed by the water, and this is the 4th temple which is built.
The islands of the Sundarbans have been shrinking and shifting for centuries, partly because of silt and subsidence. But the rise in water levels began to accelerate a few years ago.
Since the year 2000, the trend is actually steeper, upward steeper.
Pranabis Sanyal is a member of India's Coastal Zone Management Authority. Saga Island is less than 30 kilometres long. Sanyal says in the last 40 years it's shrunk by 25 square kilometres. He's been studying the Sundarbans for most of his professional life. So has oceanographer Sugata Hazra.
For the last 20, 30 years, we are getting more cyclones and we are losing land to the sea. This is the reality.
Hazra's worried about a recent surge in scepticism about climate change, fueled by widely publicized mistakes made by the UN's climate change panel, including the prediction that the Himalayan glaciers could be gone in 25 years. Hazra concedes climate change scientists do make mistakes and should correct them, but he adds,
if they lose the battle to this lobby who are trying to discredit the science of climate change, who are trying to defame the scientists, the world lose the battle.
Hazra says sea levels in the Sundarbans are rising at a rate well above the global average. He says thousands of families have already been displaced, becoming climate change refugees. Hazra says the causes are many and complex, but he's in no doubt human beings are playing a part.
Look, it is definitely a factor. It is not that it is a possibility. It is one of the most important factors is the man-made climate change.
The islanders themselves are not so certain. A group gathers in a farmyard to tell the story of a tiny island nearby. That island completely disappeared beneath the waves 20 years ago. Radha Rani Jana and her family used to live there and had to move here.
Our house and our farms all got submerged.
The families worried that one day the rising seas will compel them to move again. They too see this as the work of the gods rather than people.
Has anybody here heard of global warming, man-made global warming? Has anybody in this group heard of that? No.
We ask again using different words. Again, there are blank faces. The islanders of the Sundarbans, the people in the front line of the rising seas, know much about the dangers of tigers and crocodiles, but little of the damage mankind is doing to their world. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
This week marks the 20th anniversary of a photograph. It's a dramatic shot, even if at first glance it seems like a dark picture of nothing at all. But if you look closely, you can see a tiny speck of light. That speck is the Earth, seen from very, very, very far away. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has the story of that famous image, known as the Pale Blue Dot.
20 years ago, Candace Hansen-Koharczyk was sitting in front of a computer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in California.
I was all alone, actually, that afternoon in my office.
Her office was dark. The window shades were drawn. She was searching through images sent home by a distant spacecraft.
I knew the data was coming back, and I wanted to see how it had turned out.
Finally, she found it.
It was just a little dot, about 2 pixels big, 3 pixels big, so not very large.
It was the Earth, seen by the Voyager 1 probe, which at the time was nearly 4 billion miles away. Because of an accidental reflection off the spacecraft, the tiny speck seemed to be lit up by a glowing beam of light.
You know, I still get chills down my back because here was our planet bathed in this ray of light, and it just looked incredibly special.
Special, and yet, if you weren't searching for it, it would be almost invisible. The Apollo astronauts had taken photos that showed the Earth as a big blue marble, swirling with clouds and continents. But this picture showed the smallness of Earth in the vastness of space. The late astronomer Carl Sagan tried to express how he felt about this photo in his book, Pale Blue Dot. This is him reading.
Every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam.
Like most people, I saw it in the newspaper not long after it was taken, and kind of intellectually I thought, this is amazing.
Robert Poole is a historian at the University of Cumbria in the United Kingdom, who wrote a book on images of Earth from space called Earthrise. He says this particular photo shows what an extraterrestrial might see as it approached our solar system.
This is not our view. We've managed to go out and get the view that somebody else might have, whereas the early Apollo pictures of the blue marble were our own view of Earth.
2 decades later, pictures like this are still few and far between. They are not exactly easy to take. In fact, we almost didn't get this one. Carl Sagan lobbied for it early in the Voyager 1 mission, but others objected that taking it might fry the spacecraft's camera. Candace Hansen-Koharczyk says that's because the Earth is so close to our extremely bright sun.
There was a reluctance to take any kind of risk when we would point back towards the sun. We didn't want to accidentally damage the cameras in any way.
Oh, there was a lot of debate as to what its value would be.
Edward Stone was and still is the chief scientist for the Voyager mission.
It was not a scientific image. It was really, I think, an image to sort of declare that here, for the first time, we could take such an image. And second of all, it provided a new perspective of Earth and its place in our solar neighborhood.
But the idea was shelved for years as Voyager 1 flew through the solar system and did its science. In 1989, the mission was winding down, some staff was going to leave, and Carl Sagan made a last-minute request to please, please take this unique photo before the opportunity disappeared forever. Edward Stone says the decision went to the top levels of NASA.
because it was going to extend the mission in terms of imaging capability for an additional 6 months or so, and that, of course, did cost money.
Officials decided to go for it. In the time zone used by the Voyager 1 mission, it was Valentine's Day 1990. The spacecraft turned its cameras towards Earth, and later the image was released to the world to great fanfare. But it never really captured the popular imagination, like the famous Apollo images.
I think it was hard, it's still hard, to really get your head around the fact that our solar system is so immense compared to Earth.
Edward Stone says, to get the full impact of this photo, you really have to see it up on a wall as part of a large panorama that Voyager 1 took of the solar system's distant planets. Candace Hansen-Koharchek says her NASA center used to have this mosaic of photos up in an auditorium.
And to show the whole thing, it covered, 12 or 14 feet.
Of mostly empty black space. The planets looked like little pinpricks of light. One of them was labeled Earth.
One of the guys that took care of that display told me one time that he was forever having to replace that picture because people would come up to look at it and they would always touch the Earth.
Voyager 1 is now about 3 times farther away than it was 20 years ago. The spacecraft still routinely phones home, although its cameras no longer take photos. But if it could send back another picture, the little dot that's Earth would look even fainter and even smaller. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Do not adjust your radio. This isn't just static. It's the sound of a solar flare. Maybe you haven't noticed, but the sun's been a bit quiet over the past couple of years. It was experiencing something called solar minimum. It's a period when sunspots and solar flares are rare. But within the past week, the sun appears to be emerging from its slumber, which is good news for people like Thomas Ashcraft. Thomas is an artist and an amateur radio astronomer, and for the past 20 years, he's been listening to the skies, making and sharing recordings from his home observatory in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thomas Ashcraft, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
First of all, describe what a radio astronomer is.
A radio astronomer studies the sky at radio frequencies rather than optical frequencies. So the optical sky, the visual sky, is just a very small slice of the full electromagnetic spectrum. So there's much more to see and study in radio astronomy than there is in mere visual optical astronomy.
Because normally we think of, you know, the sort of those photographs from the Hubble telescope, these incredible, dramatic photos of faraway galaxies and stars and planets. You're not actually always looking at things. You are listening to things.
Yeah, listening, that's my forte, is listening and recording. And actually, most radio astronomers don't listen to sound. They see the radio input on spectrographs or charts. So to me, if you tune into radio astronomy spectrographs, they can be extremely beautiful, just as beautiful as Hubble images.
Sort of. What have you been hearing this past week?
Well, the past week's been incredibly special. As you mentioned, we're coming out of a very long and almost a weird sunspot minimum, but in the past week, a few active regions appeared on the sun, and one region grew incredibly fast, like in a matter of 2 to 3 days, and started flaring ferociously.
I'm listening to this, and I'm wondering when you actually get sleep, because it sounds like it's been very, very active.
Well, it's kind of nice not to get sleep. I mean, I get sleep, but I tend to get up quite early to before the sun so I can meet it. So it's this exciting time. It was a little bit flat before this.
Now Thomas Ashcraft, I should mention that there's an article about you at Wired.com. And in that article, there's a photograph of your backyard. And it's this sort of network of wires that are strung through the trees. Can you describe what that setup is and how you actually record the sound of space and of the sun?
Those are dipole antennas. So those wires that you can see are then coming into my observatory into a series of shortwave radios. And actually, I'm using old-fashioned VCRs as my audio recorders because they make an eight-hour-long tape and
oh,
I can, I don't have to attend to them. So I have an incredibly simple radio astronomy observatory built out of simple wires, cast-off shortwave radios, old VCRs that they don't even take at the Salvation Army anymore, I don't think.
You actually use your observatory to make recordings of other phenomena. Okay, to me that sounds like being on the ride Space Mountain at Disney World.
Okay.
What is that sound?
Well, that sound is, now we're switching phenomena into meteor and space dust. So what happens is when a meteor hits the ionosphere, it makes a trail of ionization. That trail or that cone of ionization has the capacity to reflect in a far-off TV or radio transmitter. So what that was the reflections of distant video carriers of TV transmitters. Hmm.
You got to be very careful because I suspect that DJs will start to sample your sounds.
I think that that's all right. I know that people find it musical.
You can dance to some of it.
Well, I do.
That's Thomas Ashcraft. He's an amateur radio astronomer in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thomas Ashcraft, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you kindly.
King Tut's reign began more than 3,000 years ago when he was nine. It lasted less than a decade. But the treasures from his tomb have made him a celebrity. And those treasures also have provoked a lot of speculation about Tut. Carsten Pusch from the University of Tübingen in Germany says that's because the statues and other depictions of Tut make him look so odd.
So this includes this funny shape of the skull, this nice belly that is always seen in the statues, or this wonderful protruding hips, and the face itself, you know, with these very full and swollen lips and this slim nose.
For decades, scholars have speculated about whether Tut had syndromes or genetic defects that could have feminized his face and body, or changed them in other ways. So Pusch and a large international team used molecular genetics and advanced CT scanning to examine Tut and 10 other royal mummies. They found nothing to back up all the speculation. Tut's skull had a normal shape, and there was no evidence of female characteristics. Pusch says Tut's odd portrayal by artists was probably just the style of the time. But he says the tests did reveal enough physical problems to challenge any assumptions you might have had about the life of a boy king.
Everything in the sarcophagus looks splendid, you know, looks like, wow, a rich person, a person that never had problems, you know, he had everything, he had whatever girls and money and a good life, and then you see, oh my God, you know, this guy was suffering more than me.
Pusch says the biggest surprise was Tut's left foot. It was clubbed, and some bones in the toes were dying. He says that would explain why Tut's tomb included more than 100 canes or walking sticks.
You do not feel well, you have pain, maybe you have a swollen foot because it's some sort of inflammation that can occur, and you cannot walk.
Tut probably couldn't even put any weight on his left foot. CT scans also confirmed that Tut had a cleft palate and a curved spine. Pusch says when you put all the evidence together, it appears that the king was frail, had weak bones, inflammation, and problems with his immune system.
I do not know any other person who has so many diseases accumulated in his body.
Pusch says those problems could have come from inbreeding, which was common in the royal family. Genetic tests using DNA from mummified bones found that Tut's probable father, Akhenaten, married a sister, and it appears Tut did too. But Pusch says that although the problems related to inbreeding probably contributed to Tut's death, it's unlikely they were the immediate cause. Earlier studies had found that Tut had a badly broken right leg, which could have been a factor. And Howard Markell, a medical historian at the University of Michigan, says the new study found evidence of an even bigger problem for Tut.
He also had a raging case of malaria.
Scientists suspect this because they found DNA in Tut's bones from a parasite responsible for the most severe form of malaria. Markell says it's likely, though not certain, that the combination of a broken bone, malaria, and underlying health problems is what killed King Tut. Markell, who wrote an editorial about the new study, says the high-tech effort goes well beyond other attempts to diagnose historical figures using documents or pictures.
It's a sort of a parlor game that doctors play all the time. But what's so remarkable about this time is that these physicians or pathologists and historians had access to the actual mummies and could put them through a whole battery of modern medical tests that we generally reserve for living patients.
Markell says this approach promises to change the way scholars diagnose the ailments of historical figures. The new research appears in this week's issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. John Hamilton, NPR News.